Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling is a live call-in radio program providing doctrinal dialogue, cultural commentary, and insightful interviews with some of today's foremost Christian authors and leaders. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Traveler's Rest. The goal of the church and the radio program is to seek the glory of God in the salvation of sinners and the sanctification of the saints by the ministry of the Word. For more information, go to www.knowingthetruth.org. Here with today's edition of Knowing the Truth is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome into this edition of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. So glad that you joined us on the program today. This is Pastor Kevin Bowling. On the program today, I want to talk with Daniel James Devine from World Magazine. He's written a couple of interesting articles about a few issues that are taking place around the country, actually. The first one up is a story about Harvest Bible Chapel and an apology that came out there from James McDonald. And so we want to talk a little bit about that. We see all these issues that are taking place with many of the mega churches that are across the country. And this is one of the latest ones that come up here with Harvest Bible Chapel. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And then Daniel has also written about a women's college that redefined the word woman. They redefine what it means to be a woman. So we want to talk about that a little bit. That deals with the Seven Sisters and their effort to accept transgender students based solely on their self-identity. So if a person just said, I am a woman rather than I'm a man, just based upon that, you go ahead and accept them on whatever, however they self-identify. Is that really, you know, the way that we should conduct these things, especially where we're talking about, you know, people being in dormitories together, using restrooms together, and showers together, you know, these things like this, it makes a difference, you know, as to who the person is. And we have to get back to talking about what people are essentially, not what you self-identify as, but essentially. God made man male and female, it says in the scriptures, in the book of Genesis. And, of course, we have gotten very far afield from that in our modern culture today. And so what do we find? We find a lot of gender confusion today. There's all kinds of confusion. Well, we can cut right through all that confusion if we just go back to the biblical definition of these things rather than all of the nuances that are introduced in our new culture today. Let's start first, Daniel, if we could. Welcome to the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
Hey there. Good to be here.
Oh, great to have you back. Why don't we start first with the Harvest Bible Chapel story that you've written about recently. This one was just posted September 15th, so just a couple days ago. Tell our listening audience what took place there and what is now taking place with this latest apology.
Yeah, for listeners who aren't familiar, Harvest Bible Chapel is a megachurch in the Chicago region with seven campuses, and the senior pastor is James McDonald. He's an author, and he's pretty well known through his radio preaching ministry called Walk in the Word, so people might find that on their local Christian radio stations, perhaps. The background of the story is last year, three elders at Harvest Bible Chapel resigned from the elder board in protest of what they said was a, quote, culture of fear and intimidation at the church and a lack of transparency, they said, among church leadership. And as it turned out, there were actually other elders before them who had also resigned and cited similar concerns. So after these three elders resigned, they joined five of these other former elders, and they signed a private letter that was sent to the remaining elder board, just citing concerns and leadership. And I've not seen the letter, but my understanding is that it was raising concerns about McDonald's leadership there. So what happened was the elder board gets this letter, and they did not agree with the assertions in it, and so they immediately began church discipline proceedings against these three elders who resigned. and specifically by name two of them because they were still attending Harvest at the time. And so they excommunicated these two former elders in a video that was shown to all the campuses of the church and also posted online for a couple of weeks. So this caused a bit of outrage among some people at the church, and there were some members who left over it. And for the past year, this happened about a year ago, for the past year, these three former elders have been asking the church to apologize. And so that finally happened this past weekend. Remaining elder board and Pastor McDonald, in a video that was shown at the campuses and put online again, they apologized. They said that they had met with these three elders and asked for forgiveness and said that they made statements about their character that were not true, and so they asked for these three elders' forgiveness and lifted the church discipline. Mm. So good ending to that story. The three elders say that they've accepted the church's apology.
Mm-hmm. A couple of points in this. The claim that was made by the three elders that left the church, that resigned from the elder board in protest, their claim was that they said that there was a culture of fear and intimidation, quote unquote. And that raises some questions again, because those were almost exactly the types of words that we heard from some of the folks that were on staff with Marsh Hill recently, where they were talking about with Mark Driscoll and what was taking place there, that they felt that there was a spirit of intimidation and so forth. This just strikes me that why are we in these mega churches? Why are there, is their own leadership coming out and saying that the way that the church is being led through some sort of a spirit of intimidation and fear, is a culture of fear that they put in these comments? So I think that you know, that really is disturbing to see that we're just finding this type of statement being made in a couple of different fronts, you know, across the country, both related to these mega churches that apparently put on a face of one thing as to, you know, how things are going, but behind the scenes, we seem to find out that everything is not quite as rock solid as they're presenting. So that becomes a bit of a problem, right?
Yeah, some people have drawn parallels between these two churches. I mean, certainly they've both been built very much around the personalities of James McDonald in one case, and then Mark Driscoll in the other. And one of the things that, you know, that both churches have tried to do is, you know, provide accountability in having an elder board where the senior pastor is supposed to be one of those elders and supposed to have accountability in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the question that's arise has been, well, how is that operating? Is it really operating as, you know, equal accountability, or, you know, are other things going on there?
Mm-hmm.
Last year, when the world reported on what was happening at Harvest Bible Chapel last year, and I talked with these three elders, and one of the things that they said was that, for example, when they asked for a line item budget for the church, which, you know, the entire elder board is responsible for approving the budget, but when these three elders asked for a budget, they said that they were denied and rebuked.
Hmm.
And they were told that even making that kind of request could get them removed from the elder board.
Oh, boy.
Which seems a little odd, you know, if the elders are in charge of approving the budget. But so anyway, that's just an example of the type of thing that they were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is the full elder board, are they really providing that accountability that it's supposed to be there for?
Mm-hmm. The whole idea of ruling by elders, presbyteros in the Greek, where it speaks about where we get the term Presbyterian from, you know, ruling by elders, is designed so that the pastor of the church does not become a Protestant pope, where his own, you know, his word is law, and he's the only one making major decisions concerning the church. So it's designed, it's not a perfect system, but it is designed to prevent, you know, just one person and one person's view on the direction of the church to be considered to be gospel or law as to which way the church should go. So, you know, the design is that you should be looking for these other men and their input and their statements about what is taking place and their leadership, their background, their called of God, just as the pastor is called of God, and they're called to be involved in the leadership of the church. And as you pointed out, at least this is how it's structured at our church, and I think typically structured this way, the pastor on that board only has one vote on issues, just like everybody else on the board. So it's designed so that, you know, he can't, it's more difficult for him to steer things in a certain direction. Now, in practice, I think the way that this works out is if you have a person that is very, very capable and very respected as the pastor and so forth of the church and very talented in what he does and so forth as a speaker and maybe a writer, and like a James McDonald figure or even like a Mark Driscoll figure, it's very difficult for there then to be any actual dissent as to what that pastor wants to do because people are very reluctant to go against the way that he wants to go, and he's very persuasive in his way that he can make his point. And so in practice, I think it doesn't always work out the way that it's planned, and sometimes there's issues, and I think we see it here. The real story here, then, is not so much that there were some disagreement on the elder board. There should be, because that's just the way you've got different people with different perspectives, and that could be healthy in many, many cases. The problem came in, it appears, from your article, where they then reacted to that difference of opinion on some things by then saying that the elders were on a mission to discredit and destroy the pastor. Well, you make those types of claims, I think you've got to show some sort of proof of that rather than just making a statement. Was there any proof put forth that these men had actually were on some sort of campaign to do that?
You know, when they the video that they posted a year ago, the church discipline video, it was not very specific in terms of laying out, you know, exactly what these guys had done. And I even asked, I called Harvest last year and asked them some questions about this. And they, you know, one of the questions I asked was what specifically was, you know, were you referring to in this video? And they would not answer questions about that church discipline action. So I couldn't really get any specifics from them.
Mm-hmm.
This past weekend, when McDonald read his apology from the pulpit, he said that they, quote, immediately realized that we erred in the matter in which it was done and in what it implied. One of the questions that comes to my mind was, you know, why did they wait a year to make this right if they knew that they did it wrong at the beginning?
Exactly. You know, there's a couple of things that seem to go in favor of the three elders. One was the way it was handled, and to come out and make these types of statements about them, you know, discrediting their character. They even had another statement in there. Not only did it say that they had tried to discredit them, but then it faulted them with having a spirit of, how was it implied?
Superiority
there?
And self-righteousness.
Exactly, superiority and self-righteousness. And so if you, you know, the whole idea of superiority was what the elders were actually complaining about, you know, that there was this a culture of fear and intimidation, that the pastor, James McDonald, was expressing superiority, this idea of greater among equals. You know, this is how we ended up with a pope in the Catholic Church. They agreed that all of the elders of the churches around the then-known world in the early centuries of the church, that they were all equal. So the elder or the minister at Jerusalem was equal to the minister at Rome and equal to the minister at Antioch. And then suddenly there was a switch that took place that the elder at Rome was then said to be. He was equal, but a greater among equals, whatever that means. He's equal, but he's more superior than the other equals. And so once they did that, that was the ascendancy of the Roman Pope that we have. Well, of course, we want to be very careful that we don't then create some sort of Protestant popes here, and these Protestant popes seem to be, if we can use that terminology, in some of these mega churches where they just begin to think of themselves much too highly than they ought, and they think that they're all that, if I could put it in modern language, and start to assert themselves this way. I totally agree with you. I think the other thing that speaks to that these men may have gotten it right was, why in the world does it take a year for you to come out after pretty much the issue has been almost forgotten from some standpoint, and then to finally come out and to say, I mean, certainly it didn't take a year's worth of investigation into this. I mean, Watergate was shorter than that. Certainly they should have been quick then to say that they made a mistake in making these types of statements, disparaging these men's character and so forth, to say that they were out to destroy the pastor, and then you come out a year later and say, oops, that doesn't bode well for McDonald's side of this equation. Do you agree?
Yeah, better late than never, I guess. yeah. We don't really know, have the three elders have agreed to be at peace at this point, and they've accepted the church's apology. We don't really know if, whatever issues that they were concerned about, if those issues have been dealt with now, are they still ongoing, or, is this a real, does this show a real true turn in direction for the leadership, if there were real problems going on there. So I guess time will tell. God's always working these things out in the background, and we'll have to see how it goes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're seeing anyways that what's taking place with the problems that seem to be taking place around the country is not just with mega churches in general, but more the mega churches that are built around a particular personality, like you said. These seem to be the ones that are kind of suspect, especially when the personality has been very controversial about the way that he has conducted things. That seems to be the category of churches where these all of a sudden, these problems are now coming to light. And I think that we should be suspect about that. I don't like that whole concept and idea anyways. And I think there should be red flags right from the very beginning. But we're just kind of seeing that a lot of the critique that has been made against these types of churches, the chickens are coming home to roost. And we're now seeing that behind the scenes there were problems for a long period of time. So I'm glad that hopefully they got it worked out. And I hope it sends a warning signal not only to that group, but to other ones that are trying to do this as well. Let me ask you about that other article that you've written that I alluded to, the idea of that a women's college is now trying to redefine what it means to be a woman. Tell our listeners about that story.
Yeah, this is an all-women's school in Massachusetts. It has a long history. It's called Mount Holyoke College. It was established in 1837 and became one of what's known as Seven Sisters Schools, which are like the female equivalents of the Ivy League schools, which used to be predominantly male. Well, this school, Holyoke, has about 2,200 students, and this summer it became the first single-sex U.S. college to accept women on the basis of self-identity alone. So meaning all someone would have to do to get it to enroll in the school is say that they are female.
Hmm.
So you don't need documentation. You don't need doctor's records to show that you've had sex change surgery or something like that. No testimonials from friends or parents. So if you say that you're transgender, you can get in. And I just got to read you this, their policy here.
Yeah, I'm looking at it.
It's funny if it weren't so tragic, but
I know.
Here are some examples of people who can apply.
So this is the official policy of this school. I just want to make sure our listeners understand that. This is who they will permit to come into this all-women's school, their college, and this is their official policy. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, published online. If you're biologically born female and you identify as a man, you can apply. If you're biologically born male and you identify as a woman, you can apply. If you're biologically born female and you don't identify as either a man or a woman, you can apply. And, of course, if you're biologically born female and you identify as a woman, you can apply. The only type of person who cannot apply is someone who is biologically born male and identifies as a man.
Mm-hmm.
So that rules me and you out, I suppose.
I guess so. You know, didn't life used to be so much simpler? I mean, we knew who boys and girls were growing up. There wasn't a whole lot of confusion about this. It was pretty clear. It was crystal clear in everybody's mind in my neighborhood where I grew up. Nobody had any sort of issues. Now we're not quite sure who is who. And I think one of the websites, like social media sites, I don't know if it was Facebook or Twitter, who it was, but that there was now like 30 different ways that you could identify yourself, the boxes that you could check. Originally, it was just M and F, you know, male or female. But now there's like there's 30 some boxes. I don't even know where they come up with all these categories. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, there is one exception, actually, as well. If you say if you were a male student that identified as a woman at the time of your enrollment, if during your time at the school you decided to change your identity back to male as it originally was, you could stay in school. So you could actually graduate. So you could be in the school and be a man and identify as a man and graduate that way.
Now, do we think that this could open up a little bit of a Pandora's box for some sort of abuse? I mean, couldn't, some guy with some nefarious motives, you know, decide, hey, I'm going to get into this school over here, and all I've got to do is just tell them that I identify as a woman, and now I can get in there, and now, I got free rein here in the the facilities. It seems like this won't be the end of the story, does it?
It would seem that way. I actually asked that question of the president of the school, Lynn Pascarella, and she said that if somebody tried to apply fraudulently, so in other words, pretended they were transgender when they really weren't, she said that would be breaking the school's honor code, and that would be grounds for dismissal.
An honor code. How do they know if a person is lying? I mean, how would you be able to say, aha, you said you were a woman, and you, even though you really were born as a man, but aha, we know now that that's not true. I mean, what would be the determining factor for them to say, here's proof positive? If we're not going to look at just the biological aspect of things and what is plain on the face of it, what other evidence could possibly trump that, and where you would say, the person is clearly a liar here, and we can't accept lying. We can accept all this other stuff. You know, you're changing your identity, based upon your words, you know, you change the essence of who you are, but we can't put up with this false statement here.
Yeah, I'm not sure how they would figure that out. It appears that the actual number of transgender students is very, very, very small. And this is not – they've got this big new policy for a very small segment of the student population. And, it's funny on the one hand, but on the other hand, you know, it is tragic. These are young people who, seem to be very confused about who they are and having a hard time seeing and accepting the way that God has created them.
Exactly.
And these kinds of policies are really confirming that confusion rather than helping them, I think.
Here's a statement at the end of page one of your article. It says this, Mount Holyoke founded as a non-denominational women's seminary in 1837, taught women subjects such as botany, astronomy, Latin, algebra, while requiring them to attend chapel services and Bible studies. Some alumni became missionaries in China, Turkey, South Africa, and the American poet Emily Dickerson attended for a year at this university as well. And so, you know, they had quite a history, and again, just has gone south. You know, we can write Ichabod, the glory has departed from that organization there, and obviously they've gone in a completely different direction at this point. We see it over and over again, the apostasy. The Bible told us, you know, that in the last days that there would be a great apostasy. There'd be a falling away from the faith, and that if it were possible, the deception would be so great that if it were possible, and it's not, but if it were possible, even the very elect would be deceived. So it's quite a program of apostasy that has taken place. And I think that one of the catalysts for that is what we're seeing in the embracing of the homosexual, now the transgender issues as well, not only by the culture, but infecting the church on a broad scale as well. Daniel, thank you so much for writing, again, bringing these stories to our attention. You don't find much mention of these types of things in any other news source than World Magazine, so we really appreciate the work you guys are doing there. And even more specifically, the stories that you write are very interesting as well. Thanks again.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Okay, that was Daniel James Devine from World Magazine. You can read Daniel's articles that we're referring to out on the webpage, World Magazine's webpage. The webpage is very simply just www.worldmag.com. That's www.worldmag.com, and you can go out there in order to find out all the information about World Magazine, how you can get, you know, you can read the stories online, but you can actually get the magazine sent directly to your house. You can find out all that information right there at that same website.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. For more information about today's program, the radio ministry, and the resources we offer, go to www.knowingthetruth.org.
Has stupid become the new smart? On the next Janet Mefford Show, I'll talk it over with Daniel Flynn, author of Blue Collar Intellectuals, When the Enlightened and the Everyman Elevated America. And is it time for the new conservative woman to start speaking out? I'll talk it over with Scotty Nell Hughes, director of the Tea Party News Network and author of Roar. That and a lot more next time. Join us for the Janet Mefford Show.
This afternoon from 3 to 5 on Christian Talk 660 and 92.9.
There's order in the rock layers. This is Ken Ham, president of Answers in Genesis and the future Ark Encounter. This week, we're learning how to use secular museums to teach the Bible's history. Yes, museums of natural history have an evolutionary interpretation of fossils and rock layers, but here's how we can use that. These museums believe each rock layer represents a different time. But for creationists, the geologic column is divided into two parts, the world before the flood and the world after the flood. You see, when the flood struck about 4,300 years ago, the fountains of the great deep buried sea creatures first, then it was animals along the coast and inland, the same order as the rock layers. You see, Scripture does explain the order in the rock layers. You can explain that as you tour these museums.
How did the global flood change the earth? You'll learn more when you visit our faith-building website. Find out about Noah's Ark at answersingenesis.org.
Personal Defense Outfitters here to help you equip, train, and defend. We offer quality handguns, shotguns, and rifles with competitive pricing and a family-friendly atmosphere. We also offer training classes, including CWP with highly trained instructors who make the classes enjoyable and informative. Whether you're looking to equip yourself with a quality firearm or seeking training, come by Personal Defense Outfitter, 12 South Main Street, Travelers Rest, or call 864-610-2097. That's Personal Defense Outfitter, your home to equip, train, and defend.
Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Well, Americans across the country are asking a fairly simple but an apparently complex question. The question that they're asking is this, what's the plan? As we look at what's taking place with ISIS, there's been such confusing statements that have come out of the White House as to what the plan is. The first thing that we noted not that long ago, the president said very candidly, I don't have a strategy for dealing with ISIS. And after he took a barrage of criticism about that statement, that he didn't have a strategy, suddenly the president seemed to find a strategy somewhere. However, the strategy that he put forth in dealing with the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria seems to be as confusing as not having a strategy. We're thinking now it might be better to go back to the time when he didn't have one rather than jump into what he wants to do now. Right now there's a bipartisan effort in Congress that is seeking to approve $4 billion to arm Syrian rebels. And Syrian rebels, that it should be noted, were supposed to be these vetted moderates in the Free Syrian Army, the FSA, and yet the Free Syrian Army is now saying they too are working with the Islamic State. So we may actually, the strategy may be at this point that we're looking to fund ISIS in order to go after ISIS. Now, if that sounds like a strategy for victory to you, I've got some land in Florida I'd like to talk with you about after the broadcast today. Well, here to try to straighten this all out for us is Patrick Poole. Patrick is a national security and terrorism correspondent for PJMedia.com, and he's written about this subject and exposed some of these comments that confusing and contradictory comments that have been made by the president and some of the others in his administration. Patrick, welcome to the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Patrick, where are we at now? What's the latest? This thing seems to be changing on a moment-by-moment basis. Is that the current situation, what I just described in the introduction, is that the current situation where we find ourselves as the strategy for the United States to deal with ISIS?
Well, later this afternoon, the House will be voting on an amendment to the continuing resolution to fund the Syrian rebels. And, of course, there no one really believes that we've been funding the Syrian and arming them for the past 3 years. There's really no prospect that they're going to be successful in overthrowing Assad, that was the whole point of funding them. And there's certainly an outspoken unwillingness on their parts to use the weapons that we're going to give them to confront ISIS. And as I've reported here over the past couple of weeks, we have several instances, at least on the local level, where the Free Syrian Army, who's the main recipient of U.S. aid and military hardware, is cooperating not just with ISIS, but with Jabhat al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda's official affiliate in Syria, around Kalamun near the Lebanese border.
Hmm.
So, you know, that is the situation that we are looking at, is that, we're funding people who are working with ISIS to fight ISIS.
Oh, boy. It certainly seems like, we're fighting... it's a divided against themselves, that they're, how can we possibly think that this is going to work out? Let me see if I can understand a couple of these things or if I'm tracking the same way with you on a few of these. First of all, when I look at the mess that we see in Iraq, I see the mess in Iraq with ISIS now taking over huge parts of the country and the infrastructure and so forth. I see this as a problem of the president's own making, that he was basically handed the victory when he came into office, but because of political statements that he had made and trying to keep his constituents that had voted for him, he was going to get out of there no matter what. He didn't leave the forces there that his generals told him needed to be kept there in order to keep the victory. And therefore, because he just stubbornly decided to pull everything out of there, he basically gave Iraq over to ISIS or some sort of an al-Qaeda affiliate. Is that a clear assessment of what has taken place, of what the context of what has taken place?
Not really. I think a lot of this goes back to the Bush administration, where it was the Bush administration that drafted the Iraqi constitution that installed Sharia law as the supreme law of the land in the state of Iraq. I mean, that was the Bush administration, not the Obama administration.
Okay.
And virtually all these ISIS leaders that were supposed to be confronting now were at some point in U.S. custody, and it's certainly during the Bush administration. But you're right that the Obama administration's sudden withdrawal from Iraq pretty much left things in the hands of the Iranian puppet government that we allowed to be installed. Again, that was during the Bush administration. That's not Obama's fault. And that that government, the Maliki government, was openly killing, jailing the very Anbar leaders, the Sunni awakening leaders that helped us put al-Qaeda on their heels. And, of course, ISIS is nothing more than Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's old outfit, you know, when they were fighting the Americans back in 2004 through 2006.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, al-Qaeda in Iraq slash ISIS, our Zarqawi's group, was able to go underground long enough until we got out. And the Syrian confrontation, which is really, I mean, that is, that does lie at Obama's doorstep, where we were going to supposedly use these vetted moderate rebel groups, which we find out are not anything resembling moderate, that we were going to use them to overthrow Assad, but now we're going to have to use them to overthrow ISIS. And the centerpiece of the Obama's Middle East policy has been we're going to use moderate Islamists to defeat al-Qaeda. Well, I mean, it's just patent nonsense. The moderate Islamists, since Obama's speech last Wednesday, are coming out and saying, okay, well, you know, we need to make peace with the hardcore jihadists of ISIS and al-Qaeda, you know, so we can fight the American invading infidel. That's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You know, when I gave you that scenario of how I was looking at what was taking place in Iraq, but you would agree that things were certainly much more stable when it was handed over to the Obama administration. We didn't have ISIS running, just freely throughout the country, just murdering people on a broad basis the way that we see it now, and taking over all this land that we had secured and handed over to the government. Granted, the government wasn't all that we wanted them to be. We don't seem to be able to find anybody over there that all that we want them to be. But it was certainly in a whole lot better shape than it is now. That's agreed, right?
No, I don't think that's the case. I think the seeds for what we're looking at in Iraq were sown. And I mean, just because there were net effects of having, you know, 100,000 plus some odd American troops, you know, that the Iraqis were able to hold it together for a couple years after that. But my colleague, Steve Conlon, wrote a paper back in 2007 saying that this is exactly what was going to happen. I mean, it was not unpredictable or somehow Obama's fault.
Mm.
You know, it was the Bush administration under Condoleezza Rice as Secretary of State that established the policy that we were going to use the so-called moderate Islamists, groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, to confront al-Qaeda. Well, I mean, as we see now, And as I was arguing at the time, the Muslim Brotherhood's always been the entryway, the gateway into Al-Qaeda. They're not, you know, the thing that we're going to beat Al-Qaeda with. They're the things that Al-Qaeda is going to beat us with. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think there's a lot of bipartisan blame to go around here. Obama, you know, abruptly pulling out of Iraq and pulling out because he made those promises to his base in the election and before 2012. I mean, that's understandable. But, you know, a lot of this does go back to the Bush administration, too. And, and failure to come to terms with that is to fundamentally misunderstand what we're looking at.
Yeah,
I mean, at root, we lost in Iraq. We left, they stayed. I mean, it's, you know, it's like, you know, we're in a situation like the Japanese trying to say they're going to confront extremists, you know, in the Marshall Islands in 1946. I mean, that's the absurdity of what the congressional Republicans are pushing, this McKeon Amendment, which will go on later today. It's absurd. I would say insanity, but I think that's still an understatement.
Yeah, at some point, though, you know, we keep going back and rehashing this idea that, okay, Bush made a mistake. I don't think we did. I think that in the context of what we were dealing with, we had, first of all, the safe haven that was there in Afghanistan, where the jihadists...
Which is still a safe haven.
Right, but again...
The Taliban operate openly. They just...
Right, but again...
They conducted a suicide bombing and killed several Americans just here a couple days ago. I mean, we've lost the war. We lost the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
We've lost the war in Afghanistan. For people to not fundamentally understand that's what we won all the major engagements. We went into Fallujah. We cleared it out. But then we left. And we came back. We don't understand what it's like to actually win a war anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you have these generals. Well, we met all of our military objectives. Well, you know, the enemy's in complete control of the field. Well, but we still met all of our objectives.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the absurdity of trying to argue that somehow that Iraq was some rousing success.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. We lost. They won, and here we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was talking about it being more manageable. We don't see that. I don't think that
we don't manage wars. We win wars or we lose wars.
Right.
It's this language of trying to talk around the fact that we lost these wars, you know, to talk about managing them or, you know, that we met the objectives or, you know, all these terms here in D.C., these things insulate, this kind of talk insulates the politicians to allow them to talk absolute nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're going to back and arm the Syrian moderates, which we've been arming for the past 3 years, and they're going to, with no prospect that they're going to defeat Assad, which was the objective in the first place, and there's no really foreseeable chance that they're going to be able to defeat ISIS.
Now, Patrick,
they haven't done so.
Patrick, what's your solution then? What should we have done?
Well, first off, I don't think we should have not ignited a sectarian religious war in Syria back in 2011. You know, that's the first thing I would have done is not done that. I think, secondly, we need to stop this madness of thinking that we can flood Syria with weapons and that's somehow going to win the peace.
Mm-hmm.
It's just absurd
that
we're going to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. But in light of that, we can't go back and undo the past, the history of what has been done. So it is what it is. What do we do now?
I don't think there's anything for us to do. Our allies have abandoned us. Turkey isn't going to let us use our air bases. I mean, we can fly some drones around, you know, and take out, what I would do is have a black ops campaign to take out the ISIS command and control. But, I mean, that's very limited. Unless we're going to go and reoccupy Iraq, anything else we're going to do is a waste of American money and American lives.
Mm-hmm.
Can we win this war? Sure. But what it would take would be unpalatable. I mean, the American, anything we're doing, even arming the Syrian rebels, is hugely unpopular with the American public. There was a Chicago Advisory Council poll that came out. Only 1 in 4 back exactly what the House GOP leadership is going to vote and approve later today.
Mm-hmm.
So, the
American people want them to do something about ISIS at the same time.
Really? I think a lot of people would like us to address the problem of potential terrorists coming over the border.
Mm-hmm.
We need to do something about ISIS. That's coming from the media. That's not coming from the public. I'm standing on Capitol Hill right now, and there are not hordes of American citizens calling into their congressmen demanding that they do this. The very proposal that they're taking up today is hugely unpopular with the American public.
Well, I think don't you think when the American public sees people being beheaded on the videos that immediately they say, you know, why are we letting these people just get away with this, and let's go over there and take care of this, and, you know, that they're over here beheading people and mocking us, and I hear people say, you know, it's time to go over there and take care of business with these extremists. But
at the same time they see that, you say, okay, well, it's going to take 300,000 American soldiers, including your nephew and your son and your daughter, and we're going to send them back to Iraq. Those same people say, oh, no, I don't want to do that. I mean, that's the conundrum that we're in.
Right.
Now, people want to do something, but we say, okay, well, now we got to send your son over to go and fight this war. Well, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, exactly. I think you're exactly right about that, when it gets down to the brass tacks of what absolutely needs to be done if we're going to deal with it, people aren't on board for that, especially in light of the way that it ended before. You know, we gave away all the victories that we had won, the treasure that we spent, the blood we shed, is all seemed to have been for nothing. Now, I can't imagine why there isn't a march on Washington by the veterans, just furious over the fact that we sent people over there who died, and now it seems to be for absolutely nothing. We just handed it over to this to a group that's just running across the country, and we didn't get anything, it seems, out of it. Let me ask you about another question.
It's not seems. That's the reality. That is what happens.
Yeah. Let me ask you about one other piece of this that is such an important component. You mentioned a number of times about us looking for the moderates to go against the so-called extremists, and a lot of people say, wait a second, the moderates are just kind of bad Muslims. It's all coming out of Islam, and, you know, so we're not going to find moderates that are willing to go ahead and do this. Is there truly moderates around, and why aren't the moderates just rising up themselves and going after the extremists if they feel that they're giving Islam a bad name?
Well, that's really a question to put to the, you know, those who identify themselves as Muslim moderates. It certainly, the silence is deafening, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
I think trying to build a foreign policy around the very proposition, that we're going to rely on these moderate Muslims, which, more than a decade of experience has shown that, you know, that's a losing proposition.
Yeah.
You know, we're continuing with the folly, and the House GOP leadership is continuing with this fiction even this afternoon when they vote on this McKeon amendment to the continuing resolution to send money and arms, which we already know are going to end up in the hands of ISIS and other terrorist groups over there.
Exactly.
Even the New York Times here on Sunday said that, you know, things are trending against these groups and trending for the jihadist groups like ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you have the New York Times editorial board with a sitting Democratic president, criticizing the policy, I mean, it's really seriously time to rethink what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you on that part that, this strategy is just a recipe for failure. And, to be thinking that we are arming the people that we're fighting against. I mean, it's just so disheartening for the American people. They have no confidence whatsoever in our government to be able to deal with these issues, and it just seems no strategy whatsoever on any sort of a foreign policy. You were right about, how does this relate to the idea of America itself? The glaring omission that there was, in my mind, from the president's speech the other night on this issue was, what about our border? How do we stop these people from coming into the United States itself? Let's put our focus and our millions and billions there to stop them from coming in. And then as for these other areas where they're mostly fighting each other half the time, that maybe we should just let that carry on. And doesn't seem we can do anything, at least we don't have a plan to do anything that's going to make any significant difference. Should we be doing that? Should all this attention be upon our own border?
Well, I don't know if all the attention should be on the border, but certainly we need to be doing more. But point in fact, the reality is that nothing's going to be done about the border.
Hmm.
We have Barack Obama in the White House for the next 2+ years, and really no willingness on the part of Congress to hold his feet to the fire to get something done. That's exactly what's going to happen. And when we have dead Americans on the street again, just like we had last year in Boston, people are going to scratch their heads and, wag their fingers, and nothing's going to change. I mean, this is the government that we elected,
mm-hmm.
And we're reaping the whirlwind because of it.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got an election coming up here in November. That's the rumor, at least. people need to get registered and vote and let members of Congress know that these are important issues to them.
Exactly. We have an organized revolution coming up here in November. If you want to let your voice be heard, here you go. Here's the opportunity for you to be able to do that, and I certainly hope that happens. I think that we can put, even beyond that, we can continue to put pressure upon the current administration. They said that they withheld off of doing amnesty already because of the pressure that was put on them. I think the pressure came from the Democrats that were in positions where they were vulnerable in the upcoming election. But whatever the case may be, there is ways that we can exert pressure upon them, and we should take advantage of the opportunity to do that. Patrick, thank you so much for writing about this issue, and thank you for the work that you do there on talking about these important national security and terrorism-related issues. Obviously, these are critical, critical issues for our country, and I appreciate you helping us to think through this. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
Patrick Poole, as I mentioned, is a national security and terrorism correspondent for pjmedia.com. And so you can go out there to read his articles. He's written some articles on this issue, and you can read what he had to say specifically about the idea of funding these terrorists that are in Syria now and trying to get them to do the fighting against the terrorists that are in Iraq and portions of Syria as well is just a failed strategy. And I don't think anybody who realizes that right there, that we're funding a group that is joined together with ISIS and trying to get them then to go against ISIS, when it's put that way, people just see the ridiculousness of it. We need a change. We need a real change taking place in our leadership here in this country. Remember this. In all the things that we talk about, though, the Lord Jesus Christ said, He said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." We'll see you next time.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth. To keep this ministry strong and coming your way, you can make a financial gift at knowingthetruth.org by clicking on the donate button.
You've been listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Traveler's Rest. For more information about the church and radio ministry, visit us on the web at knowingthetruth.org.
The opinions expressed on today's program are those of the announcers, their guests, and callers, and do not necessarily represent those of the staff and management of His Radio Network, the Radio Training Network, or Clear Channel Communications.